This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
In 1983, President Ronald Reagan's National Commission on Excellence in Education published a report called A Nation at Risk, The Imperative for Education Reform, which essentially said the country's schools were failing. That report started the school reform movement and, according to some educators, began a system designed to punish teachers rather than enrich students.
Because our kids are so much more than what they produce on a single test on a single day about a single subject.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a school superintendent from Texas who thinks public education in the U.S. is under attack. We'll also spend an academic minute with fainting goats because, well, come on, they're fainting goats. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Is there a war on teachers in America? That's probably hyperbole, but to some educators, the education reform movement in the United States is targeting teachers in public schools in hopes of bringing more private, for-profit schools into the system. That's part of the argument John Kuhn makes in his new book, Fear and Learning in America: Bad Data, Good Teachers, and the Attack on Public Education. John Kuhn is a school superintendent from Texas who, after reading and seeing media reports attacking American schools and working with testing systems that seem designed to punish rather than evaluate, wrote and published a plea for help that's known in education circles as the New Alamo Letter. I spoke to John Kuhn recently and asked him how he thinks the majority of Americans would respond to this question and how he would respond. Are America's schools broken?
I think America would respond yes, and I think I would respond that it's not that simple.
All right. Well, let's find out just how unsimple it is. What seems to be the perception problem that Americans have about their schools and teachers in general?
There is a breakdown between the way Americans view schools in general and the way they view their own children's schools. People with a direct connection with a public school, 80% of those people will answer in polling that the school that their child goes to gets an A or a B in their opinion. But when you ask those same respondents about American schools in general, it's flip-flopped. It's 20% would give those schools an A or a B. Now, these are the schools out there that they don't have a direct connection with. So there's a definite breakdown between the opinion of schools and the feelings of a specific school with specific people and teachers that that folks know.
And, well, let's get into that. And, again, I did the other part of the question was how they feel about teachers. Teachers seem to be taking a beating lately.
Teachers are taking a beating, and there is a reason for that. There has been an ongoing campaign to discredit and demonize teachers in the United States over the past 30 years. The accountability movement, which I believe was begun with good intentions to improve schools, has really kind of gone off the rails and turned into a movement to discredit schools and teachers. And there are a lot of different factors at play. There is a heartfelt desire to improve schooling in poor areas where children struggle to learn. But then mixed in with that, there are desires among some people to profit off of education, and so one of the things that folks are doing is trying to make people unhappy with the public school system so that they can offer an alternative. And then there are also ideological factors at play. There are folks who don't like taxation. They don't like the public sector. They don't like teachers' unions, and so they use this sort of marketing campaign against public schools and against public school teachers to advocate for their preferred ideologies.
You say it goes back about 30 years. Does it begin with A Nation at Risk? And tell us what that is.
I think that's probably sort of an artificial starting point, but it's a good starting point because that is where the campaign really took off. There have been reports about schools throughout American history, and often those reports, even before 1983 when A Nation at Risk came out, often those reports were fearful documents about the future and our children are not learning the way that they should. The difference with A Nation at Risk was the reception. It was well received in the public by the media, even by public school teachers and college professors of education. Nobody wanted to appear to be defensive and dismiss the findings of that report. even though there was good reason to be dubious and skeptical of some of the findings in the report, because, for example, one of the kind of the linchpin findings in A Nation at Risk was the fact that American students' SAT scores had plateaued. They were not rising. Well, there was a reason for that, and it wasn't simply that our schools were failing. Instead, the main reason that SAT scores had stagnated was because we had increased the number of kids going to college. And when you have more kids going to college, that means you have more average students, not just your stellar students, going to college. In fact, we had thrown open the doors to college so that more female students, and more minority students, more low-income students were taking the SATs. So this fact of stagnating SAT scores was actually good news, but it was presented as a dire, horrific fact.
And then talking about some of the demonization, quote unquote, of teachers, you have to go to a report by John Stossel back in the early 90s, right?
Well, that was the first time I noticed it. Me personally, as a teacher, I came into teaching and was quietly doing the job of a teacher, and it's a tough job. Being a teacher anywhere in the United States is a tough job. You've got the pressure of taking care of your students, doing right by them. You've got the pressure of the expectations of the community, the pressure of the expectations of your bosses, and now the pressures of accountability, having to get your kids to score successfully on these standardized tests. And so it's a hard job. When I began teaching, I didn't realize that there was this this current of discontent with teachers and public education. I had no clue until that one fateful evening in the late 1990s, early 2000s, when I watched a program on 2020 called Stupid in America. And, you know, looking back now, I say in the book, it was a better example of confirmation bias than it was of journalism, because what I saw was example after example of public schools that were not working and a complete blackout of any sort of information about public schools that were working well. The fact is, we've always had both. We've always had very successful public schools, and we've always had public schools that don't work. But in that program, it was portrayed as though the most dysfunctional public schools in the land were representative of public schooling as a whole.
Was it also represented that teachers were immune from any sort of consequences?
Yes, that was one of the key points in the piece that John Stossel put together then, that teachers had jobs for life and had job protections. And he used a situation in New York City where teachers were placed in rubber rooms rather than let go when they were deemed ineffective teachers. And that was put out there as though that was a common thing. I had never heard of a rubber room until I saw that report, and I had been familiar in my short teaching career with folks being, you know, moved out of teaching that because they weren't effective. But it was a scary program, and if you weren't familiar with public education, it could definitely sway your opinion. And I think there's been a really relentless campaign to produce programs like that, to produce organizations that beat that drum, journalism that touts the same message. And so it's really no wonder that the public perception of public schools in America today is at a low point.
Go back to what you said about accountability. The accountability right now, it just kind of equals testing, right?
Absolutely. The testing is the heart of the vampire. That's what the outgoing education commissioner in Texas said when, at the very end of his term, he criticized the standardized testing overemphasis. It's almost a mania at this point. Testing is everything, and that's unfortunate because our kids are so much more than what they produce on a single test on a single day about a single subject. I'm not sure why we have fixated on math and reading to the exception of everything else that schools do with kids. We have so many programs, so much great learning that goes on in schools to boil it all down to two simple subjects and a test given on a single day and call that accountability, I think is false.
You give a couple of good examples of that in the book about a couple of students who you call Joe and Alex. Tell us about their stories.
Well, yeah, I tell the story of Joe, and I change the students' names to protect their privacy, but Joe was a great kid. In fact, in the book, I say he was a kid like denim. He was a well-behaved kid, very active in athletics, popular with the adults and the kids. He was kind, but math wasn't his thing. And so when it came to his senior year, he had not passed the math tax test. And back then in Texas, the test required for graduation was called tax. He had passed the other required tests to graduate, but he had not passed the math test. And he came into my office. I was a principal at the time with his mom, and his mom was upset, and she informed me that he wanted to check out a school. He wanted to go to a home school. In Texas, unfortunately, we have some quote-unquote schools that are really more like diploma mills, and this is what he wanted to go to. He called it homeschooling, but it was really a diploma mill. And I tried to talk him out of it. I told him that he needed to graduate with his class that he had been in school with since kindergarten, and that a high school diploma was something no one could ever take away. But he was convinced that he was not going to pass the test. He had tried a couple of times and had failed, and he was finished with the indignity of taking and failing this test. And I'm still mad about that. I'm still mad about that because a high school diploma is a stamp of approval that we give to American youngsters. And this kid, this young man, was such a success in so many ways, but there just happened to be this one thing that capriciously and arbitrarily we have all decided is the thing you have to be able to be released to the world as a successful young person. I think it's very arbitrary, and I think it's very wrong what the system did to this young man. He walked away. I tried to talk him out of leaving school, and I couldn't do it, and his mom couldn't do it. The other young man you mentioned, I call him Alex in the book, similar situation. Alex was an absolutely stellar welder. In shop class and in welding, he could produce really amazing products. And we have a contest in Texas for students that participate in programs like that. And he went and advanced all the way to the state level using the skills he had learned in school. He was an artistic young man, and he did well with drawing and in art classes. But where he really shone was using a welder. And he came from a line of people who worked with their hands, and he was proud of what he was able to do, and his dad was proud of what he was able to do. So this was another really successful young man who had an area and had an avenue and a pathway forward for his life that he had already settled on in high school. But again, just like the other young man we talked about, the tax math test was something that he really struggled with, and so he had also not passed it. And we come to his senior year, and he had the advantage, I guess you would call it, kind of ironically, that he had an identified learning disability, whereas the other young man did not. And so because he had an identified learning disability, he was able to graduate on an IEP, or an individual education plan, and was not therefore required to pass the state testing. He could be exempted from it. So this young man, in a very similar situation, he was able to attain his high school diploma without passing that tax math test.
Still to come, my conversation with John Kuhn, author of Fear and Learning in America, continues with a look at how private business interests are looking to get a piece of the education money pie. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1236. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is John Kuhn, superintendent of the Perrin-Witt Consolidated School District in Perrin, Texas. We're talking about his new book, Fear and Learning in America, Bad Data, Good Teachers, and the Attack on American Education. Is there an agenda, and by agenda I don't mean a conspiracy, but is there an agenda of trying to work towards more privatized education?
I think a lot of us in the public schools fear that that's the driving force behind the education reform movement. We look at the movement, and I try to be generous and acknowledge that at the outset of the movement, there were good intentions at play to improve education for the poorest American children where sometimes public schools struggle. But when you look at the movement as a whole and you see the philanthropies, very large philanthropies that are driving millions and millions and even billions of dollars into a whole host of reform initiatives, and you see that how these initiatives play out, they all kind of coalesce into an effort to exaggerate the bad in public schools and minimize the good in public schools. And every aspect of this reform movement seems to be driving that same point. Public schools are bad. Public schools are bad. Public schools are bad. One starts to wonder if the point of all this is not to move away from a public school system to a free market system where for-profit schools are able to operate at a profit.
What do you think that would look like?
Well, we know what it would look like because that's what Chile has. The nation of Chile, 30 or 40 years ago, took the ideas of Milton Friedman, who is the father of school vouchers, and they implemented a universal voucher system. It failed. In fact, about less than a month ago, Chile's government announced that they are moving away from their universal voucher system because what happened was what many of us in the United States fear will happen with our system if we continue on this path to privatization. The vouchers were provided to the students, and wealthy students were able to supplement that government voucher and pay tuition at elite private schools with the voucher as a discount on that tuition. Middle-class students were able to take that voucher and add a little bit of money to it and go to kind of mid-level private schools. And then the poorest students in Chile at that time had only the voucher to pay for their schooling. And so some for-profit schools were opened up to operate very cheaply and only at the cost of the voucher. And then you also had what remained of the public school system. So as a result, what you had in Chile was a really dramatic stratification of all the people in Chile, all the students in Chile by class. All the wealthy kids went to these elite private schools, the middle-class kids went to the middle-class schools, and the poor kids went to the public schools. That's what we're afraid of, and that's why there are so many of us advocating for public schools, because what we're afraid of is this de-democratizing movement away from the public mission of public education.
Well, then let's look ahead. What needs to happen in the next 2, 5, 10 years to not only fix what needs to be fixed, but restore the faith in public schools?
I think there is a silver lining right now. There's been a great deal of pushback on this reform movement, and there's been a great number of organizations and individuals who have begun to stand up and say, we are not giving up on teachers and we're not giving up on public education, and we're also not going to buy all these magic bullets that people are peddling. In my book, I offer six different prescriptions that I think would help us to move toward a stronger, healthier public school system and help us keep our eye on the ball. One of the things we have to remember is we're talking about a system. So when people bring up an anecdote of a bad school or a bad teacher, those things do happen. But as a system, the public education system in the United States of America is there for every student. It doesn't matter where you live. It doesn't matter what disabilities you have or whether English is your first language. None of that matters. There is a school for you in the public school system in the United States. That's a great promise. And these other movements away from that, they don't offer that same promise. Now, they may offer a school, but it will not be a school for any and every student who lives in that district. So the six prescriptions that I offer in the book, the first one is that we need to implement universal pre-K for children that are low income. We've seen studies, and I mentioned a study in the book, that shows that for every dollar you spend on early childhood education, there's a return for the nation of $7 for that investment. It's one of the best investments that we can make. The second thing I recommend in the book is that we remove property worth as a factor in school funding. We have guaranteed that poor children will receive a comparatively poorer education by denying them equal funding that we give to public schools that are in wealthier areas, and that's a travesty. The third thing I recommend is that we enlist better gatekeepers in educational preparation programs, and what I mean by that is that our teacher preparation programs need to become more exclusive. That is one of the things that the nation of Finland implemented and it resulted in one of the best education programs in the world. And one of the key things they did was they elevated the profession of teaching so that it is on par in their nation with being a doctor, being a lawyer. The fourth thing I recommend is that we use testing for diagnostic purposes and not punitive purposes. This is one of the biggest mistakes we ever made. The fifth thing I recommend is that we reject any accountability formula that ignores context. Specifically, what I mean by that, we have schools in areas that are high-funded schools, and we have schools in areas that are low-funded schools. But all schools have to get the same percentage of their students to pass these standardized tests. That's unfair, and it's also almost guarantees that schools in our poor areas will be declared failing and, in the worst-case scenario, be closed down. And the last thing I recommend is that we amplify teachers' and students' voices in policymaking. There has been a deliberate exclusion of teacher voice and student voice when it comes to education policy. The policymaking environment has been commanded by business interests and politicians. And when teachers have spoken up, they've been ignored. And so I think we need to have, at the federal level and at the state levels, a real concentrated effort to get teachers and students to the table to talk about what works and what doesn't work in education policy.
John Kuhn is superintendent of the Parent-Witt Consolidated School District in Perrin, Texas. The name of his new book is Fear and Learning in America, Bad Data, Good Teachers, and the Attack on Public Education. Okay, I'm just going to take a deep breath and say this because it brings me joy. Fainting goats. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. You may have seen video clips of some interesting goats that seem to faint and fall over. As Philip Sponnenberg, professor of pathology and genetics at the Virginia Maryland College of Veterinary Medicine, explains, these little animals have a lot of desirable qualities.
The first thing to know is that fainting goats don't actually faint, but have the muscular condition myotonia congenita. So the episodes leading to the common name don't occur in the brain at all, but are limited to the muscles. The condition prevents the muscle cells from relaxing quickly after contraction, and this leads to the situation where the limbs stiffen, and if the goat is off balance, it can fall over. The stiff episodes are over in a few seconds. This trait gives these goats a host of common names, including fainting goats, stiff-leg goats, nervous goats, or wooden leg goats. The important detail is that they never lose consciousness during these episodes. We know from related conditions in people, dogs, and other animals that the condition itself is painless. In goats, it actually has some advantages. These goats were long valued in their original Tennessee homeland because they are easy to fence in. They cannot climb or jump, which makes them much easier to manage and contain than other goats. In addition, they are quiet, good mothers, resist parasites well, and have heavier muscling than goats without myotonia. All of these attributes combine to make them a good choice as a meat-producing goat, a role for the breed that has been increasing recently. They are also popular as pet goats due to their quiet attitudes. This breed of goats, in common with many local breeds, became quite rare in the late 20th century. Numbers plummeted to the point that the Livestock Conservancy listed them as threatened. Population numbers have now increased, so that the breed is now much more secure, leading to an upgrade in its status as recovering. As far as anyone knows, they are uniquely American, so guarding their status here is essential to their survival globally.
That was Philip Sponnenberg of the Virginia Maryland College of Veterinary Medicine at Virginia Tech. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we've got for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.